Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE, and on this podcast, we feature a keynote session from the 2011 EDUCAUSE Southeast Regional Conference. It's a panel discussion featuring Larry Conrad, Vice Chancellor and Chief Information Officer for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Catherine Gates, Chief Information Officer for the University of Mississippi. Robert Johnson, Vice President for Student and Information Services at Rhodes College. And our session moderator is Sandiford Julius Schaefer III, Director of the Advanced Learning Center at the University of Memphis. The presentation is entitled, Can We Do It? Making It Work in the New World.
Still interesting, strategic, important, needed at our universities in these difficult times when we're all tightening our belts, changing the belts, taking off pieces of, you know, clothing, body parts, feels like at any rate. And this is a conversation that has come up, frankly, with some of my staff from time to time about, oh my God, with all the budget cuts and layoffs, you know, why don't we just hunker down and just, you know, let's just get through this and we'll see where we are on the other side. And my own feeling is that that would be the easiest thing in the world to do and the exact wrong thing to do. I mean, our universities now more than ever need creativity, they need innovation, they need rethinking. And yes, nobody likes budget cuts, nobody likes reducing services, nobody likes layoffs. But I think we simply have to seize this opportunity to try to, you know, I know it's hackneyed, but think outside the box and try to think of ways that we can move our institutions forward. So we think at Chapel Hill that what I'm going to talk about here for a few minutes is an example of that, and we're actually pretty excited by it. So let's see if I can make this work. All right, so the basic idea, or the title I should say, is Reimagining the Computer Lab, and that's a word that we seized on very specifically. But a little bit of background, first of all, the Central Computer Labs at Chapel Hill are funded entirely by student technology fees. But due to the budget pressures, we've been asked to look at ways we might be able to reduce costs. That's come from the budget committee, that's come from the student government leadership. Nationally, the concept of, and indeed even the need for student computer labs is under review scrutiny. There's been some of our colleagues who have just kind of said, well, that's it. You know, students need to take care of their own technology. We're getting out of the business entirely. And I think many of us are watching to see how well that works. I mean, frankly, if that's a workable solution, you know, great. Then we can take our limited resources and put them somewhere else. However, nobody likes to reduce services to students. So what we have decided to do, sort of when we started down this path, maybe as a middle step or a shorter step, we said, well, before we go that draconian, let's challenge our lab support team to engage with students about what they would like to see if we reimagine the computer lab concept altogether. So they took that challenge to heart, and they engaged with several student groups. And what we heard back was they wanted the following things. They wanted collaboration space. They wanted more of a focus on learning space. They wanted multiple study zones. They wanted more space to spread out and study. They wanted comfortable seating. And they wanted better lighting. And of course, vending machines and coffee. So, this was good feedback. And so we went to work on that. And another aspect of this it wasn't part of the first round of thinking on this, but as our thinking progressed, we approached the library and said, look, libraries got a set of computers in their space, and in a couple of the libraries, we've actually got, you know, computer labs that are in the same space. It's time we ought to try to work together. So, as I said, the ITS, which is the Information Technology Services Division, presently have separate computer installations. So we saw an opportunity to partner and reduce costs for both. And the library is under stress, too, of course. So we came up with this following proposal, which was that ITS would consolidate the present 5 computer labs. And I'll note that 2 years ago, it used to be 7. So we've definitely been consolidating. Consolidate that down to 3, and all of them in library facilities. And that we followed the reimagined layout, which I'll describe here in a few minutes, that the central IT group provides the capital funding for the computers and furniture, which is where the library wins. And the library then provides the first tier support in the libraries, because they got to have staffing anyhow. That's where the central IT group wins. And then ITS would provide that second tier support. So if they're folks who are librarians, get into trouble and they can't answer a question and solve a problem, well, we provide the safety net. So that's the concept we're pursuing. And I will and we see the reimagined idea and the partnership with the library as sort of two sides of the same coin. I will tell you candidly, the very first time we sat down with the librarians, we sort of got this. There was I won't say it was negative, let's just say it was a little jaundiced. They were, that was kind of, well, what are you really trying to do here? We got past that, and we've had several follow-on meetings, and they're really enthused about this idea. But I got to tell you, that very first meeting, the body language was immediately clear we had some sales work to do. Okay, so very briefly, because this should look very familiar, I suspect, to all of you. What's the traditional computer lab look like? Well, it looks something like this, Rows of tables, rows of computers, kind of a messy thing, really set up for students to work pretty much independently. So that's been the before concept. So what we did is we worked with a designer, and we picked a particular lab that happened to be one of our lowest use labs, one of the newest labs, but also the lowest use labs down sort of in the residential area of campus. And this may not be terribly clear from the. Oops. What do I need to get a? Here we go. Here we go. All right. So we tried to take this concept of really trying to build in the collaboration space all over the place. Okay, so we've got some cordoned off areas here, which you'll see better in the pictures, where students can cluster together, work together. We've got that sort of all over the place. We also left some of the individual rows of computers that students can utilize. But again, there was very, very much a rethinking of supporting collaboration space, relaxation space, some separate meeting rooms where students can get together in a little more privacy. So that was the concept we were going for. Now, this is an example, one shot. Also show several of the after shots. So you can see it's sort of a kinder, gentler kind of a space that we were going for, more welcoming, if you will. So I'll show you some examples of what we have actually seen of real students at working in this lab. And I should say this: we launched this as a pilot last summer. We did the remodeling over the summer and ran it as a pilot over fall semester. And then, as you'll see in a minute, because of the success, we've been talking through the spring semester about the expansion. So here's some more examples, and this thing here is this is a decidedly low tech thing, but it's really innovative in my mind. They just took a whole wall, painted the thing with essentially paint that you can use a dry marker on, and it's great. I mean, they can get creative, they can share stuff, and you bring out an eraser and wipe it all off. It's a really creative idea. Again, here's an example again of that collaboration space. An example, we threw in some of these large displays. so that students can, as you can also see the laptops. I mean, I should have noted earlier, we're a laptop university, have been for a long time. And that was one of the aspects we were looking to leverage as well, is that, well, look, students can use their laptops. Let's focus more on space to let them do that. And we have a virtual computer lab concept where, you know, they don't need to physically go into the lab anymore to get access to specialized programs or files or even access to printing. Here's talk about they want a more comfortable study space. I thought this was a good example of that. Here's a case of, row of computers that the students can access and plug into. And, of course, vending machines and coffee, very important. So what did we see from that? Well, what we've seen is that in the fall semester, we piloted this reinvention, the reimagining of the student computer lab in this particular location called SAS-B. We redesigned it with that learning space focus that hopefully was very evident as you looked at those pictures. We removed two-thirds of the laptop, of the computers that were in the lab. Usage doubled, and a resounding success. I mean, we were pretty stunned by that, frankly. We were worried about reducing the number of computers that were available to the students. And what we found is, we really felt like we'd hit on a good combo. So we anticipate saving two ways. First of all, fewer computers. So we have lowered capital costs, and of course the recurring. A lab computer, you have to recycle those every 3 to 4 years, typically, depending on how hard they get beat up on. And from the partnership with the library, so we'll see lowered support costs. Okay, very quickly, I should have asked this. Do we have internet access? Oh, well, so we'll just have to forego that one. Do we have wireless? Yeah, well, so much for that idea. It was a terrific idea. But anyway, this is really nothing more than just a sort of show. And if we post these slides, you can go click on this thing, and it'll just show you in about a minute and a half. It'll show you the movement from sort of a webcam a view over the course of a day. So this is how we advertise the thing. We've got a huge sign on the building outside, really emphasizing this combination of study, work, and refresh. Okay, thank you.
Oh, I'm on, right? So we're going to hold questions. We're going to have Kathy Gates from the University of Memphis, Mississippi, another university starts with an M. Tell her story. Thank you, Larry. And then Bob will come right after. And I got to thinking about the three stories. We have a physical space, a virtual space, and a people space, if you will. That's actually a nice comparison among stories. Kathy?
It's good to be here and to see you all. I think you should get a gold star for being at the last session of the conference, of a very good conference. I want to tell you a little bit about our project. Actually, today it's called Ole Miss Today. Next week it's going to morph into UM Today, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Before I get into it, I want to acknowledge Frank Matthew and Pooja Saxena, who worked on this project, and also Robbie Seitz, who has been here, who is our campus webmaster. So it's hard for me to imagine any software application that you use for 12 years, but we really did use something we called Email to Groups for 12 years. It was an email-based, text-only communication system where you could choose from a rich set of demographics. You could send to your advisees, your class, you could choose female, freshmen, sophomores, whatever, who are this and this. You could choose all instructors for a current term. You could choose student employees and more. It was text only. We got increasing numbers of requests for attachments and other kinds of media. The messages came in all day long as email, and so our deans refer to this as internal spam. And then from a technical perspective, is very inefficient because you're sending the full text of the message to every person on campus, depending on who you chose in that target group, every time. So we were creating this burden on our email system. So we went to a new method for internal communications called Ole Miss Today. And actually, next week on campus, I've learned something. We have the SEC Communicators meeting on campus, and they asked us to be part of a panel on internal communications. And so to the PR people, they know what this means. To the IT people, we just wanted a way to get out our own announcements to students and faculty. So we are rather unique in that we run SAP for both our business and our student systems. University of Kentucky does, University of Northern Kentucky, Central Michigan. Quite a few universities run SAP for their business systems, but not so many for their student systems. But in SAP, you can create your own customer tables. So we created customer tables that sit on top of a relational database to store these messages. We kept what we liked in the old system and the ability to send to all kinds of groups, and we added even more, like building mayors, and we have, you know, just about honors students, provost scholars, any group you can think of. But in the new method, rather than the message going out as they send it, it goes into this database, and then we send a daily summary, but also when they log into portal, they see those messages in real time. We now can support just about any kind of media you can think of, and we've got a mobile view of both the email that goes out and the portal view. We have 30-some-odd message types, such as athletics, provost, chancellor, campus police, and then we've got priorities assigned to those message types, so we can order how the messages are displayed. And then a suggestion actually that came from users is an ability to see a table of contents and new items. So when you look in the morning, you can see what came in since yesterday or since the last business day. Now, another feature, before we were updating the campus website, the portal, the emergency website, every time there was news. Now you just enter into Ole Miss Today and all of those places are updated automatically. So if you go to the Ole Miss website in the lower right, you'll see our bulletin board. When you enter an announcement, you can mark it as a candidate for the Ole Miss bulletin board, and a review takes place, and if it's suitable, then it feeds into the bulletin board right there. So here are some screenshots. This is what you see in the portal. And you'll see these two messages over and over, study abroad and e-forms, in different formats. There's the content and new items that we talked about. I put this screen in for a couple of reasons. First of all, this is the bulletin board that we talked about. So that same human resources announcement you saw on the previous slide is now feeding to the bulletin board. But I wanted to show off Ole Miss's new mascot. we are becoming the Rebel Black Bears. And we've had a year-long voting process, and you got a sneak preview right here. Now, IT ran the polls for this mascot, and we got to read the narrative comments, and a theme that came over and over was, choose a good mascot, we don't want to be the laughing stock of the SEC. So we'll see how it goes. This is the mobile view of those same announcements. If you go to m.olemiss.edu and log in, you'll get to see the messages that are targeted for you. Then we had, in this session, we want to talk a little bit about the politics of how we do this. For me, it usually takes 3 tries to get something perfect. So we launched it in September, and then we ducked, waited for the comments to fly. And we had a round of feedback. And in that feedback, we got a lot of really good ideas. So one of the new things that you can do, We, for our emergency text messaging, cut over to a system called 2SMS.com. And one reason we did that is we had a need for emergency text messages, but also for non-emergency text messages. And we just pay a flat rate. It doesn't matter what kind of text message it is. So we've got this hooked up to our SAP system, and when you send out a message, if you're authorized, you can also send a text message. The next thing we did that I thought was pretty cool is that when you send, and this is very recent, as of the tornadoes. This idea came out of the recent tornadoes. A lot of emergency websites have a running list of all the updates. And so when you send a message to Ole Miss Today, it automatically updates that emergency website. There's no manual effort. Lots of times these messages are coming in the middle of the night. You don't want IT people to have to go work some kind of magic to get the website updated. So that the users have an interface to send the message, and that automatically goes to the bulletin board and automatically goes to the emergency website. We have the ability to put an acknowledgement on messages in Portal. So we're using that in IT. Our state legislature, or our state institutions of higher learning, requires that our employees and students sign off on a policy related to illegal downloads. So in Portal, you can create a message that has an acknowledgement required, and our users have to sign off, and we set it up so we can repeat that. So once a year, they'll have to sign off. And then this don't show again was, again, a comment from the user community. I don't want to see the message about the kayak trip to Ocoee, which is a great place to go, but I'm not going to be able to go, and I don't want to see it again in my messages. So we have a don't show again feature. We have the ability to look back in the history and see what messages. The next area is, I think, of the one area that I'm really excited about. We're now posting these messages from our academic processes. So an example is, if you're a student and if you had two or more D or F midterm grades, you get a message in Portal where it's private, not an email, telling you to go see your advisor now. And that's coming out of a process. Likewise, if you're an advisor, you get a list of advisees who had two or more D or F grades. We've got a similar one that your window's about to open. Go register. And then a day after your window opened, if you didn't register, your window opened, but you didn't register for classes. Go do it. So here are some screenshots. This is the log from 2SMS.com that shows some of the kinds of text messages that are going out that are non-emergency. So, dear students, the bookstore has 13 copies of the Thermo text. See you Wednesday, Dr. Will. It's kind of fun to snoop and see what they're doing. This is the weather page that gets updated with the messages, so you get a running log, all from that same interface to submit messages. Now, how do we get feedback? We used to have a paper newsletter called the Tech News. And in the last year, we converted that over to a WordPress blog. And so we went live in September, we ducked, and then we waited for feedback. We asked for feedback, and we posted back to the campus what we heard and what we're going to do. So this is the first round of feedback in October. And then in May, we did it again, but this time we had some student focus groups. And so we posted back to campus what we're planning to do and asked for feedback on these ideas. Now, the newest thing that we're going to do, and we're kind of sneaky about this, we have a branding issue. The Ole Miss brand is known worldwide, and that's a really positive thing. But most of our faculty prefer to use the University of Mississippi. And in our focus groups with students, they didn't realize that these messages were customized for them and they were official university messages. So next week, in the middle of the night, while everybody's sleeping, this will morph into UM Today. And we've added a tagline, your one-stop source for alerts and announcements. And actually, we stole that partly from Carolina Alert. We looked at other places that had this kind of thing, and you guys have a one-stop deal. And then we'll put the student's picture in the message to try to re-emphasize that this is custom-built for you. So some of the things we've talked about for the future, we're not integrated with the campus calendar right now. We need to do that. That's, again, a political issue that's in another group that's in a lot of transition right now, and I kind of need to let that settle down. Student feedback is they've said they'd like to see these messages in Blackboard. We think that's technically possible. And Facebook, we think that's technically possible, and if it had a graduate student looking at that. So it's not a real fancy project, but it's a basic problem that's common to everybody. It affects everybody. People have emotional attachments about these. When we went live with the new interface, some of the faculty said, I have more clicks now, and you know, we had to address that. We don't want them to have too many clicks. And then one theme with all of our projects that I have found just through the years is that you put something out there, then you hunker down, get feedback, and come back, and that builds credibility with people that you're going to listen and you're going to do it. You're going to listen for the good ideas and come back and do them. They believe in you and they'll participate. At one point, we were summoned to a liberal arts meeting to talk about Ole Miss today and what's going on, and that everything was cool. The cost, in this case, it was really, we were able to use existing hardware. We're building on our existing infrastructure, so there was no new software or hardware cost. The only cost was for the two SMS.com messages. So that's my story.
Good. Thank you, Kathy. Bob?
First of all, I want to say thank you to Sandy for organizing this and inviting us to be part of it, and for the extra tech help he just gave me. I also want to say thank you to Lida and Leslie, the EDUCAUSE support team. When they ask, you say yes, because it's good to give back. And I want, again, like Kathy, I want to thank you for coming. I'd imagined a room of about five people at the end of this, and I thought I'd have just thanked them all. But and I wanted to explain this title, Building an Abundance Mentality. My first title was Integrated Work Learning in the Private College Setting, which just put me to sleep before I got through it. Way too pedantic. Bricks Without Straw. I thought that's just too depressing for words. I had one called Don't Plant Kudzu, and I thought, no, it's a little esoteric. It'll make sense later, though. But I stopped with this one, Building an Abundance Mentality. Has anybody read about abundance mentality or thought about that? It's this notion that we're surrounded. Thank you. I appreciate that hand. Thank you, sir. It's this notion that we're surrounded by riches that we don't see because we're conditioned to look for something else, or to overlook what's around us. And one of the examples that's commonly given is that of boarding an airplane. Although everyone has a seat, people will crowd to the gate and rush the gate. Like, I've got to get my seat. And maybe it's to get carry-on space or something else, or just to elbow somebody in case they should sit in a seat that's between you and yours. But the notion is that there is a spot for everybody. And if you think about how you're going to board the airplane, it's really not going to be so bad as to think that you've got to rush everyone to get there. And then behind that is this notion, which I know is all very tiresome for everyone, that of working smarter, not harder. But another example is that of food in the U.S. And this is an example that may ring this may ring true, or you may think, well, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But it was one of the examples, and something I read about an abundance mentality, said that when people from the third world come to the U.S., they are absolutely overwhelmed by how much food there is, just an enormous amount of food. And some of it we know where it is, and it just gets wasted at restaurants. It gets wasted all over the place. But they say it's even growing in our yards. There are mushrooms, there are nuts growing on trees and fruit growing on trees, and it falls and it's gone and people go hungry. And as a result, we have not trained ourselves to see the abundance around us. Okay, so that was a little pedantic too. But I'll sort of flesh this out, and you can decide for yourself whether, in fact, we need an abundance mentality or whether we're as in a position where that doesn't really make as much sense. But I'm from Rhodes College. It's a very small school compared to most of yours. Has anybody heard of Rhodes College? Yes! I mean, we're so small we couldn't afford. Yeah, well, we... seven. We've had seven. But we're a residential liberal arts college in Memphis. We have 1,700 students, and we're so small I couldn't afford color on my slide. But my story is different from the ones that came before. It's as opposed to a physical space or a process space, a virtual space, as Sandy put it, it's more of a people space. It's about using people. And my story is about the use of student work to transform Rhodes College and the organizations that make up Rhodes College to provide a better education at a lower cost. And I am serious when my president came up to me and said, Bob, what I want you to do is raise the value of the education while lowering its cost. And that is exactly what he said to me. And it induced a lot of sweating. But I'll describe the principles and process guiding the establishment and implementation of this work learning program at Rhodes. In 2003, members of Information Services, Financial Aid, Accounting, Career Services, and Human Resources, already odd bedfellows, collaborated to produce a student employment plan that would offer staff jobs to students on a competitive basis. The program has been a resounding success, creating 100 jobs for students. Again, this is a school of 1,700 students and a staff roughly of about 450. So creating 100 jobs, this was a good thing, and meeting fractional FTE needs for staffing and avoiding as much as $750,000 annually in cost to the college and cost to the families. These offices, the offices that produce these jobs, compete for the positions that they offer. The students compete for those positions themselves, and the college pays them a competitive wage. So if you heard compete or competitive in there three times, you'll see at least one of the major components of this program. The result is satisfaction all around in accomplishing more at a substantially lower rate, increasing the value of the education while reducing its cost. And not surprisingly, this program's been especially valuable to Information Services. I won't go into all of the problems that I know that we all experience, but certainly controlling college cost annually for the parents and for the students is a really big one. And complexity drives cost. Complexity is cost. And if the public concern over college cost and doubts about the federal support of financial aid isn't enough, certainly internally we have enough of those concerns ourselves. And we did even back in 2003. For those of you who don't know, my president, Bill Trout, was the chair of the Congressional Commission on College Cost in 1998, and this has been a big concern of his all along. So we were concerned about it, and we also wanted to make sure that concern that the public would have over the value of the education was equal to our concern about its cost. We wanted to make sure it was valuable, relevant, and worthy in the eyes of parents and students. And finally, we have to put in retaining in there somewhere because of the departure puzzle that nationally one out of every four students who start college don't graduate from that college. Keeping students personally engaged, involved, and invested in their education in the institution is therefore of primary interest to us, especially since if we're talking about finite resources, most of ours, 3/4 of them, are coming from these students that we need to hang on to. And our goal was that of, and here's your reference to kudzu, we wanted a solution that wouldn't create an even worse problem. Everybody in here knows that kudzu was meant to control erosion, and it became a bigger problem than erosion. It's fabulous. I wish this stuff were edible because we would be drowning in food again. But as it is, we wanted a solution that would improve student access, it would improve learning, engagement, and inspiration without impoverishing either the institution or the family, a solution to increase value without increasing cost. I think all of us have heard of work colleges like Berea, and that's not our mission, it's not our identity. We all know about federal work study, and we know that there are big problems with that and the way that the culture that's grown up around it. We didn't want either of those. Now, the solution that we did arrive at, producing staff jobs for students, is not an original solution, obviously, but it is one that has existed in America for a long time. In fact, it used to be the solution for faculty who try to remind you of the good old days when they did the administrative jobs. They've forgotten the good old days before that, which was when students did the jobs. In the Depression era, students exchanged time and talent and staffing jobs in exchange for tuition. And at Rhodes, the director of communications was a student. The executive assistant to the president was a student. What we were suggesting here was not a new idea. It was just dusting off an old one and bringing it back. And you might ask, well, why, if that was such a good solution, why didn't it last longer? Because institutions got wealthy enough to move on from it. It was because we had the wealth that we dropped a solution that was working. Then when the GI Bill came through and there was even more money available for certain kinds of students and certain institutions, it was completely forgotten altogether. Bigger dollars came from greater sources, and we lost it. Except at the work colleges, where there's a whole other dynamic going on. This is more limited in scope and much more focused in relationship to the academic program than a work college, where one might be a janitor for the college. This is not that kind of deal. But it's also, as I said, not a federal work study. It is, although it does complement federal work study, I'm talking instead about a prestigious professional work program, which we call the Rhodes Student Associate Program, featuring competition and assessment. It's competition among the students for the jobs, competition among supervisors for the positions, and competitive wages. We do battle in Memphis with, FedEx. We also do battle in Memphis with Outback Steakhouse. We don't want to lose our students to them. We want to use their talent, and they have an immense amount of talent. But to do so, we have to provide specific job training and experiences, general management training. We had to offer the potential for management of other students, true staff-level jobs, and a professional portfolio to develop from their initial involvement in the program to the end. And to that end, we assess the program, we assess the jobs, we assess the students and the supervisor. We try to make sure that this thing really is delivering on the value that we want. The four steps that are involved are exactly what you see up front, so I won't read them to you except to say that our intent was to keep this from being a competitor to the academic program. It was meant to complement it. It was meant to be able to show to parents when they gave their kid to Rhodes to come, hopefully come back ready for the workforce, that we had something concrete for them. It was going to be apprenticing. It was going to involve kind of training that you would give to any other staff member, including sending them off for certifications, if that made sense, sending them off to conferences like this one, doing whatever it is that they needed to have. And we trusted the supervisors for that input. Now, from the benefits, the program costs significantly less than full-time staff positions while providing similar productivity. Additionally, we see process improvements from putting the customer closer to the process. Students are able to see some things, and they're able to tell you some things that staff can't see or won't tell you. Faculty don't perceive the program as a competitor to their interests, but as a support, since the program reinforces the academic program, either by matching students and their jobs to their academic interests, or even providing programs of work that could be used in meeting internship requirements, practicum experiences, or other applications of the classroom activities to work activities. And the persistence of the participants is always higher than 97%. It's between 97 and 100. And there's some obvious reasons why that might be the case. There's a self-selection bias. There's a program bias. But we love it when we can use a program like this to hang on to students with a number like that. It has also increased the student satisfaction, not only through particular targets of opportunity, but also in contributing sweat equity. Students go from being consumers to being citizens. The students asked for this program. They love the program that we developed, and we developed with them. And we figure that what's good for student satisfaction when addressing it is also supportive to the academic program, then it's good for the institution.
Am I back on? Great. Let me bring up, I'll tell you what, we've got plenty of time. I've got, 11? Put my watch off, 11:20. So I hope we had three different stories. They were very different. I hope that someplace in there, somebody's got some questions they'd like to ask. And who has the microphones? Who's helping? Well, there's one posted in the middle, and I suppose we could take another one off. Who would like to ask a question? That question is posed to Bob.
Yeah. How do you ensure that multi-year commitment from students?
The what coming
the multi-year.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I'm getting over a cold, and my ears are partly working. The way that we ensure the multi-year, and it is in some ways an unenforceable contract, is we spend a lot of time with them up front as they're going through the interview. And truthfully, there's enough trouble getting into the process, all the things that they have to do in filling out creating a resume and interviewing, that it's the sort of thing that is going to make them think long and hard about whether they want to do it. But we make sure that it's a minimum of 2 years. And if, as we're going through the training, we see that they are planning on doing something else, then we move on to another student. But we have fired students, and we have fired supervisors. And the word gets out, and students help reinforce with other students. Don't do this unless you plan to stick with it.
Again, for Bob, actually, considering this is an IT conference, how involved is your IT services division in providing jobs for students like that? And can you talk a bit about the training?
Certainly. Thank you.
as it works out, it, for this has been a huge benefit for IT. We provide a lot of jobs, and I know that everybody here is frustrated with the fact that you train up a student and they're gone. What we do is we create something of a training sequence. In the first year, we're looking for that incipient interest, the potential, and then we start to apprentice them in. By the second year, we start looking for people to get into that job. Sometimes we start them in their second year, sometimes the third. But we make sure that there's always a chain. One student is preparing another student behind him or her, or sometimes two. And we also use the students, and this is maybe perhaps more to your question, we use these students to supervise other students. And that's been one of the hugest benefits in information technology, is that we had staff who were eaten up their time was eaten up. They weren't literally eaten up. Their time was eaten up by trying to manage all these students. And as it was, that was often in off hours, late hours, weekend hours, and it was reducing their quality of life. They turned it over to students who were there all the time. And the students really do a good job of managing other students. In fact, they'll get in their face a lot more than a staff member will. We had staff members who say, but they're students. They're here to study. Not the student. No, they have none of that. They get in the face of these other students and say, you wrecked my weekend and you're not going to do it again. I'm going to fire you. And the problem goes away. And I really love that. It's very good.
Question is for Larry and Kathy. Both of you rolled out very significant campus-wide innovations. Could you talk more about the various groups that you had to work with to develop buy-in, to get their support, the funding, the approval, all of those things that go into making a successful change on campus?
Okay, so I'll take first stab, and I'll start by saying, and we're not done yet. But so for this idea of reimagining the computer lab, it's a combination of rethinking how we do the lab, but also remember we're reducing the number of facilities. So university libraries, undergraduate student government, there's a related but separate student technology advisory board we've had to work with. There's the student affairs group where we're going to remove one of the labs. There's the School of Public Health where we're going to remove one of the labs. There's the student union where we're going to move one of the labs out of into the library. Then we discovered, well, there's a organization in the science library that has a set of graduate students that they work with. So it's been a fairly long and evolving set. You know how it is in higher ed, right? Everybody wants to be part of the conversation and the decision, and you have to bring people along. That's the process of consensus building or sausage making or whatever it is we do. But, the good news is it does work. And what we found is that while certainly nobody's excited about the prospect of reduced services, where we've been able to focus the conversation is to try to move that excitement or move the focus and the discussion to the excitement about the rethinking of the process. And so far, knock on something, it's working fairly well.
Yeah, our groups are basically information consumers and information providers, and trying to balance the needs of those two groups and help each one see what the other one is facing. So the providers at first did not believe that their message would receive the attention it deserved if it wasn't sent as a standalone message immediately. And once they understood that, a lot of people find that very irritating, you know, that I'm okay with getting them all in one. Then we tried to break the perception that sending standalone does not equal importance, that there are other ways to show that the message is important. Sending standalone means it's time urgent. You know, that it's raining and commencement is not going to be in the Grove. It's going to be inside. That's when you send immediate. It doesn't reflect how important the message was. So trying to balance between these two groups. And it's just talking with them. Then we trotted around and met with some of the academic units that wanted we do this formal feedback process, and I like that a lot, where we post our plans for something and get feedback, because lots of times they think of things that we didn't think of. We've got a new accessibility policy that we just posted this week. Kind of like when technology standards groups post and ask for public feedback, that I always get good suggestions that way. And then students. One thing I hear is students don't read Ole Miss Today. So we've had face-to-face focus groups with students. And the things they tell us were not on my radar at all. One of the issues that they had was that they weren't seeing those nice graphics because in their webmail, by default, the graphics are turned off. So they were turned off by that message and didn't look at it. But our systems group, knowing that, could then do some configuration to make a message from that address automatically have the graphics enabled.
My school's in the same kind of process with a new communication to get away from the internal spam. But how long did you prepare folks for the change? I mean, did you sound a trumpet for a while and then say, it's coming on October 21st? Oh, not something else.
Yeah, well, the timing of the change is important. We like for everybody to get back in the fall and get off to a good start before we start making some big changes. And if you ask people on my campus, they would probably say we didn't give them enough preparation. But that's kind of a strategy, too, is to stay a step ahead of them and be ready to react.
So did you already have this system imagined and built before you started letting people know it was coming along? Or
we did.
Even
we
before?
Had years of feedback on okay. the limitations of the old system.
Right, right.
And so, you know, we...
You knew what the problems were.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Am I on? I have a question for Larry. In looking at the configuration, this is something we wrestle with on our campuses. Looks like you're skewing some of your, or shifting the expenditure from a lot of computers and technology stuff to a lot of furniture and construction, and which strikes me, or at least on our campus, we have this technology access fee that specifically says you cannot spend that money on furniture. And I didn't know if you ran into any like dealing with the different budget areas and guidelines on the money you spent of having to shift it from what we traditionally call technology what looks like a lot of furniture and construction costs.
Well, no, that's not a particular restriction that we have. As long as we're spending student technology fees in direct support of student technology, it can include remodeling costs. And yeah, it's absolutely true. That space that we piloted, very nice space, nicely appointed. So yeah, there's some money associated with that. But remember, we also didn't buy 2/3 of the computers and the printers and such that we would have normally put in there. And we have every hope that the life cycle on that is going to be a little better than what we saw on the hardware.
Then I'll stand and wait. But a follow-up for Larry. I mean, the concept of taking out 2/3 of your computers in the computer labs makes a lot of sense to me. The challenge we've had in our areas is we go back and look at our computer lab usage. And though we've said for 10 years that the students have their own devices and it's going to start going down, it's going up. You know, so I mean, you've got a laptop campus. So I know that got to help. But can you talk a bit about how do you deal with the students' needs for technologies if the computers are no longer going to be there?
Sure. And let me sort of back into that. So when we started talking with some of the various groups about this concept, one of the groups pushed really hard, says, well, let's go survey the students. Okay. So they went and sent out the survey, and they asked students, would you like to have fewer computer labs and fewer computers in your lab? Anybody want to guess at the results? No, of course not. I mean, what we believe is that we actually saw from this pilot and from the conversations that we did have with the focus groups that we engaged with, is that it's the space really that's most important. And that's the thing they didn't want to lose. They didn't want to lose the study space. And yeah, there's some complaints, and we're going to take a look at this as part of our laptop program. And we found that Students complain about the weight of the laptop, so we actually have another initiative. We've just started to reimagine our laptop program in the wake of iPads and that sort of thing. The results, we think, pretty well speaks for itself, because what we've kept the same kind of usage statistics, and we would agree the usage has been going up. But maybe this falls into the category of never waste a crisis. So we're at the point now with the students where, they want relief on student fees. Well, okay, that money's being spent for something, so you have to give up something to see relief on student fees. And so far, we've gotten a very good acceptance and buy-in, including the new student body president who has bought into the concept.
I was going to ask you about the academic impact on students. You and I chatted about that earlier. What, if any, of the students come through this work program, how has it perhaps carried over into their academic work?
Most of the students who've participated in this program find their classroom experience to be more relevant, that it's rooted in something. They have a quick application of it. And the strength of their response to the program has driven the development of another larger program at Rhodes. We're calling it for now Fellowships Program. And a fellowship at Rhodes is much like you would have in a grad school. It involves working closely with a faculty member on something of a long duration. And it's simply what we've seen as a success of this in terms of the academic program is driving some innovation in the academic program itself. And I have to say, as an ex-faculty member, that driving any kind of innovation in the academic program is a pretty big success. It's a change-averse group and a change-averse area, and I think that it sort of speaks for itself.
This would be a question for any or all of you. Curious what kind of success you've had, or can you share with us what you have found to be the most successful way to get feedback from faculty, from staff, from students on your campus on your initiatives?
Well, I'll go first. We use a combined approach. We use this approach where we post an idea and get feedback through our internal communication system. We'll go and meet with faculty, and sometimes we're summoned, sometimes we're invited to go to chair meetings. And then with students, inviting them around the table, have some food involved, and just chat with them. One thing I wanted to mention is that I'm always taken aback. On our campus, it's liberal arts. The professional schools will communicate their concerns in a way that's similar to how IT people would communicate them. But sometimes in liberal arts, and I'll just go on, especially in English and in history, they're very expressive, and they use words like horrible and disaster. and for me, Katrina is a disaster. The tsunami is a disaster, and I always kind of do like this. But a skill, an important skill, if you're going to stay at a place a long time, is to let that roll off and not react to it, but to listen for the bit of truth that is in what they're saying, and then try to address that bit of truth, but not to get sucked into it and not to be emotional back.
And I just have to comment on that. There's a saying that has been associated with Alcoholics Anonymous for years that goes something along the lines of, ignore the messenger, look at the message.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, and I think it's hard to do. But anyway, so my part of the answer on that is I'm going to respond sort of larger than just this project. I think this project is a good example. I think these times in particular, when you have to make hard choices, there's sort of two things I've seen at work. Number one is misery loves company. Everybody's going through belt tightening and service reductions, and while nobody likes it, what we found is that when we go out and we talk to various constituencies on campus, it's kind of a, yeah, you know, we had to reduce our IT support too, or whatever. I mean, there's an understanding, you know, maybe it's the never waste a crisis moment there as well, but there's greater understanding, reluctant though it may be, that difficult choices are necessary right now. The other part is, and I've tried to eat my own dog food on this, I think this is particularly a time when you really have to make sure you've got the governance processes in place and you use them. So, for example, in the last year and a half, we put up a fairly comprehensive IT governance structure, including, you know, one of the committees is an instructional technology coordinating committee that's part of the larger structure. And, you know, this has got, you know, the typical cross representation, mainly not IT people. And we've run, like, this particular idea past them. We've got their buy-in, and, of course, they want to know, have you talked to student government, blah, blah, blah. But there's also, you know, there's other areas, like as the CIO, I've reached out to our, in our case, we don't have a faculty senate. We have something called the faculty council, same idea. And I invited, you know, the faculty came to me and the council came to me, and they were, you know, complaining about reductions of services and the changes we were making. So I invited them to form an advisory committee. I said, look, you know, I'd love to hear more directly from faculty about what the implications are. I mean, we don't do any of this stuff for ourselves. So if we're doing things that don't make sense or they're creating problems, we're trying to solve problems. But if you don't see it that way, we need to know that. And we've done similar things with student and also the distributed IT, you know, the people who are in IT who are outside of the central IT group. So I just think that now more than ever, you know, you've got to create those communication links, and you got to use them.
It erodes is simply if you don't participate in the assessment, then you don't get to keep your job. If you're a supervisor and you don't participate, you lose your job. If you're a student and you're participating as a student associate, you don't participate in the assessment, you lose your job. It puts the incentive really close to the assessment.
Michelle Kleckner from Elon University. I had a question for Bob. For your students that are in the work program, do they get internship credit, and is that a formal process, and what percentage do get internship credit if they do?
To this point, the faculty in most departments have not wanted to give internship credit, but they do use it as a plus in their pursuing graduate opportunities and career opportunities for students. That is, they use it that way. But they've been slow to adopt it for internship credit. It's only by co-opting this into their fellowship program, the one that they started, that they've been able to say, okay, now we'll accept this for internship credit. But it's kind of come in through the back door that way. And we're happy about that.
I have a question for all three of them, unless somebody wants to jump in. It might take it. I don't want to treat this as a bookend, but it's a question I want to ask all three of them. That if you had a chance to do this over again, what would you do differently, if anything? And I'll let you all decide how you want to. Who wants to go first?
Well, I'll jump in. So, two things on our project in particular. I think. We could have done a better job on. I would like, if we did it over, we'd try to do a better job on it. One is, we'd reach out to student leadership sooner in the process. We engage with students, but not the student government leadership. That was a sort of a secondary realm. And same thing, I think we'd invite the libraries in for conversations earlier while we were, you know, sort of creating the concept and have that participation on both of those groups. As we created the original idea, as opposed to creating an idea and then, you know, letting them respond to it.
I don't want to sound arrogant and say I wouldn't do anything differently, but I think what is key in our project is knowing that your first cut is probably not going to be your final cut, and building in these iterations where you make it better and then better. And for me, it's about three tries. The second sort of lesson is, don't let snipers derail your project. And that's what I mean by this one out there saying, it's horrible, you've ruined my life, I've got more clicks now. What, do you have so many clicks and then you die? that So, you know, you want to stay the course and listen and try to respond, but don't react. The third, and this is key for me, you know, you see a shift in how we work where we're doing, some places are evolving into organizations where they basically have contracts with vendors. I firmly believe that a university of our size is best served by having a capable IT staff so that when you get ideas, you can say, oh, I think we can do that. And I don't have to buy anything new. We use our creativity and our skills and we do it. And that's really where the joy in work comes, from being on a team where everybody cares and everybody wants it to be really great. For me, that's what motivates me, and I hope the other people. And you've got to have the talent and smarts and creativity and an environment where they can flourish.
I don't know about you, but I've suddenly become really concerned about how many clicks I get before I die. That's got me terrified. For us, I think if we were to do it over again, we'd spend more time thinking about something, even something good, as still being a change. That is, in large part, we saw what we were doing as bringing something to the table, giving something to the campus that it hadn't had before, solving a lot of problems, particularly the fractional FTE problem, where you don't really need a full person, but you need at least a person to make something work. And so we saw it as all good, but there can't be any kind of change that is just all good. There's always something in there that isn't very good. And if nothing else, change itself is kind of a problem. I think, well, my president, and at least in private, will refer to change as being like Tennessee goat meat. You get a bite, and the thing seems to grow in your mouth as you go. And it's I'll never mention that again. Sorry about that. but I think we ran into a lot of embedded assumptions about what students can or can't do, or whether it's right to give staff wages to students, or things of that sort that really for us weren't that big of a deal. It was just something that was part of either the cost of doing business or the part of the benefit. That actually sometimes what you see as being the benefit, others will see as being cost. And if I were to do it over again, it would be to take into greater consideration that something that seems so unambiguously good might be perceived to someone as bad. And I would spend most of my time doing this over again with supervisors. And it's the thing that I've thought the most about since this program got started was how poorly prepared our supervisors are. And I don't mean simply the student work supervisors. I mean supervisors. That there are, at any level, that we don't seem to give much time and attention and resources to preparing people to be good supervisors. But this program rests from start to finish on the strength of supervision. It doesn't mean that the supervisor gives a list of things to do and the student goes out and does them. Quite to the contrary, we expect these students to be doing a job just as we would any staff member. They have a great deal of independence, a lot of autonomy. Consequently, their only arbiter of the institution's vision and values is through their supervisor. And we almost take that entirely for granted at almost every level. And when we're working with full-time employees who are continuing, we have a chance to redress that. But when we're working with students, the problems that are caused by that are usually closer together and of greater strength. So we need to. If I were doing this again, I would spend a great deal more time on the front end with supervisors, making sure that they understood what was expected of them and how to be very good supervisors, and not assume that most of my training had to be directed at the students. The students, in many cases, are doing a better job than we expected. The staff and faculty who are supervising are in many cases doing a worse job than we expected.
I think what we might want to do is let's go ahead and thank all three, Bob, Kathy, and Larry.
This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.